Dash number 12319.
Mr. Card Real Farm.
Right. Now, when they'd gone, we had very little work to do. Some of our lads were sent down to Aden, and they were dropping supplies to the natives down there. But the rest of us were just sort of filled in time training the odd person here and there. And so it was no surprise to us when, in 1944, it was discovered that we would be moving again. So we moved then, in the early part of 1944, to a place called Gioia del Col in Italy.
What del Col?
Gioia del Col.
How do you say
it? It's Gioia. Does that sound like it? Gioia del Col. It's a little village in between Bari and Taranto. And we moved over there, set up our establishment there. And we were training replacements for... we found out there was the... I think the 5th Scottish or 5th Scots Parachute Battalion... Yes, there was the 4th, 5th and 6th had gone into Italy because the 6th Royal Welsh Fusiliers, a lot of those were went ashore in Italy in landing craft, and the landing craft sank. And I think an awful lot of the 6th Royal Welsh Fusiliers were lost out there. So we were training replacement for this for the 4th, 5th and 6th. We were also training the usual agents. And I had, on one occasion, 5 officers, and one of them, I think his name is Amory, who's now, I think, the MP for Brighton Pavilion. He was an agent, a British agent out there, working one of the military missions, and he was one of my first trainees in Italy.
What did you make of him?
Very nice man indeed. I met him years afterwards at Abingdon. He came to Abingdon when I was there, and one of our squadron commanders was showing him round, and he mentioned to him, he said, well, you were trained in Italy, sir, weren't you? Paris. He said, oh, yes. He said, well, this instructor was out in Italy, and he looked at me, he said, your face is familiar. Don't I know you? I said, yes, I said, your instructor. Of course you were, he said. And we spent about an hour, I think, chatting away about different things, about parachuting in Italy and what he'd done and this, that and the other.
How did he perform as a parachute jumper?
Very good. Very, very good indeed. You know, he was... what? I don't know how old he'd be then. He was in his 40s, perhaps. He was... He performed just as well as anybody else. Very good indeed. I always had a little, tend to have a little sympathy with the higher ranks because I felt that they were placed in a bit of an awkward predicament in a way. No matter how they felt, how scared they felt, they were not allowed, shall we say, the privilege of turning around and saying, well, I don't want to do it, I'm sorry, that's it. Whereas an ordinary private soldier could do. No one thought any the less of him for doing it. They just returned him back to his unit. But I felt of an officer who felt just as scared as what they were, refused. And I can never, ever, to my knowledge, recollect one refusing. Well, he had to do it. Let's face it, it's not a very nice prospect, really. I trained one very high-ranking officer who he walked in with the territorials, which was years later, he walked in to his batman one day and said, Corporal, whatever your name was, we're going on a parachute course tomorrow, pack all my kit, you're doing it as well. And this bloke nearly dropped to the floor because he didn't want to parachute. He'd never intended parachuting, but this brigadier he was at the time had said, right, you're parachuting, and that was it. And I don't think this brigadier ever made a decent landing. He's not alive now. Ever made a decent landing in his life? He sat on his bottom because he used to have a showing big pile of wadding. He said, "Aye," he said, "you can do all this landing." He said, "but I've got all this in my backside, he said, and he showed me this big lump of rubber wadding. I did have a little bit of sympathy with them on that point of view. Not only that, we also had in Italy, we were training some of the Italian paratroops. By that time, of course, the Italian was on our side, and we had, for want of a better word, I suppose, the Italian Blue Devils. And one of my friends was quite shocked one day, because these people had to turn up for work with all their guns and everything, you name it, they'd got it. And they wanted to do their jumps and things, you know, do the ground training with all this, and we wouldn't let them. I should say that they were trained by the Germans first. They were trained in the German techniques, and we were converting them to our technique, which is slightly different.
These are Italian paratroops?
Italian paratroops, yeah. And on one occasion, we had one of them whose parachute didn't work in quite the usual regulated manner, and he whistled down towards the ground and hit the ground very, very heavily. And to all intents and purposes, he should have been killed because he had very little parachute supporting him. And we were surprised when we picked him up and sort of carried him off the DZ that he was still alive. And the next morning, he was parading outside the parachute packing section, drawing a parachute. He wouldn't draw a parachute. He declared that English parachutes were non bono, and there's no way he was going to jump an English parachute ever again. And he was trying to convince all his mates that it'd be a good idea if they did the same, but fortunately they didn't. It was just one of those things. And he got away with it, so don't always complain about. We had those to train, and we were training the, as I said, the Radiant Support Regiment, and on occasions we'd stand by to drop people, but it never, always something happened the last moment, and we were always taken off it. This used to sort of niggle us in a way, because we found out that our mates over in England and in Chaklala were involved quite heavily in operations, dropping agents, for example, in France, Germany. There were parachute instructors on the Arnhem operation, on the Rhine crossing. One of the instructors on the Rhine crossing took a parachute with him, put it on, and according to him, fell out the aeroplane. He told us afterwards in confidence that he didn't fall out the aeroplane, he just followed the troops out just to see what it was like down below. One chap was shot down on one of the operations there and was due to be married, but eventually got back and was married. I was told a very interesting story by a friend of mine, one Robbie Robinson, who was a tall, that I mentioned him before, rather big, dour Scotsman. He's one of these people who knew Queen's rules and regulations inside out and backwards. He had an argument with one chap one day about a certain paragraph in Queen's rules and regulations. And this chap said, "Look, Rob, you're wrong. I can prove to you that you're wrong." Robbie said, "Oh, well, you can't." "Oh, yes, I can," he said. "I'll prove that you're wrong." So he went and got Queen's Rules and Regulations, opened it the required page and said, "There you are, Rob. It's black and white." So Rob looked at it and said, "Ah, it's a misprint." And that was it. That's the type of chap he wanted. Anyway, we were talking about this film, The Man Who Never Was. And Rob said, "Ah, that's nothing," he said. "I had something different to that." And we said, "Come on, what did you have then?" "Well," he said, "I remember one time," he said, "when I was in Chaklala," he said, "we wanted to drop an agent behind the Japanese lines." I wish I could do this in a Scots accent, but I can't. He said, "I wanted to drop this agent," he said, "behind the Japanese lines," he said. "But we had to drop him and make it look as though his parachute had failed and he was dead and he'd have a lot of information on." So he said, he reckons they went through all the dives and whatnot in Calcutta and found bloke, but he wasn't dead, so they made certain he was in a way that looked as though he was going to be killed parachuting, fixed the parachute so it would fail, a very difficult thing to do, believe you me. It's not easy to pack a parachute to make it so that it won't work. because it's just not easy to do. Anyway, they arranged it so this chap would look as though when he hit the ground, his parachute had failed. Obviously, you can't tie things together because Japanese would have spelt a rat. So he said they found the chap, they fixed the parachute, and they dropped him. He said, but the first night, Rob said he went over and it was bad, they couldn't drop. The weather was bad, so despite the fact they got a dead body, they still wouldn't drop him because, again, you'd smell a rat. You can't drop a bloke in a very high wind without people thinking, well, it's too windy to drop. So he said it took him about three goes before they eventually took him over. He said by that time, Rob said he went over with a peg on his nose because this bloke was rather smelly a bit. So they finally dropped him. How true that story is, I wouldn't know. I said Rob swears blind that it was true and it actually happened with him.
Was he suggesting they'd murdered him?
That was his implication. They gave him the chop to make certain. They said they just picked up a body. Again, how true that was, I wouldn't know, but that was Rob's story. He was quite a character. He unfortunately died a couple of years ago, but he jumped off the track a little bit to give you an idea of the type of man he was, handicap and nothing on him. We work at Abingdon one day, and we usually worked up, we'd been on early, we'd knock off at lunchtime, and he'd gone home at lunchtime. His wife worked in the Ems Naffy there. And Rob marched, went to his quarter, sat in the armchair in front of the fire, had a nice fire going, fell off to sleep, woke up feeling rather cold. The fire was just on its last legs, so he gets up, walks around to the naffy, and he saw one of the other instructors' wives there, a lady, and he said, hey, Hen, he said, is Reen around? That was his wife. She says, in the back there, Rob. Well, I'll wait until I come home, he said, the fire's going out, I want more coal on it. That is a true story about him. That's the type of fellow he was. But we had, again, in Chaklala, we had a chap by the name of White, Flight Sergeant Chalky White. Now, one of the chaps who was on my parachute course was a Flight Sergeant Williamson. He was posted out to India about the same time as I went out to the Middle East. And he went on an operation, dropping agents behind the Japanese lines. And the aircraft crashed, and everyone aboard except the navigator was killed. Now, they had word back that this navigator was still alive, but they did not have the native didn't have the facility to keep him alive. Could they send medical help? Now, this was not far from a Japanese base, and they didn't, it had to be handled very carefully. So a doctor volunteered to parachute in. He never parachuted before in his life, but he volunteered to go in. So Chalky White, one of the instructors there, he volunteered to go with this chap and sort of give him a quick instruction while they're flying to the dropping area and give him instruction on the way down and help him, which he did do. They landed quite safely, found the village, organised a trio. The headman had organised a group of natives to move this fellow. They had to wait while the doctor examined him, and the doctor wouldn't let him move for about 3 or 4 days. So they had to stay there 3 or 4 days before they moved him. They started moving him, and they had to pass this Japanese base, and the natives got frightened and all disappeared. So they just left Chalky, the doctor, and the patient, and a couple of natives who stayed with them. So Chalky had to go off. He went out and found some more natives who they persuaded to be the bearers to carry this chap out. And I believe it was one of the greatest feats of jungle survival that was known in the First World War, in the Second World War, and probably since, in that they had to traverse through the jungle over the hills before they got to China and brought them back. And he was awarded the, I think it was... he was awarded one medal, which and afterwards they brought out the Conspicuous Gallantry Medal for aircrew, which at that time there was no medal between the Distinguished Flying Medal and the VC for aircrew, airman aircrew, and they brought out the Conspicuous Gallantry Medal air, and he was one of the first recipients of that. It was Chalky. So you can see that in the Middle East, we had it easy, really, compared to the lads at home who were I say, involved in instruction and also flying on operations, because we were supposed to be non-combatant. We weren't supposed to fly on these. So we were a bit peeved in the Middle East that we weren't involved in all this sort of thing. About toward the end of 1944, things started to slacken off again, because you know the war was gradually, you know, coming into its close at Arnhem, and the Rhine crossing and one thing and another, and things were turning the corner for us. There'd been the landings in France, southern France, I think, at the same time. And it was obvious the school was going to move on again. But before this, we had a group of about six instructors posted out to us. Now, up to that time, I'd been the youngest down there, and a young chap came out by the name of Turner, Frankie Turner. And Frankie and I got on well with each other, because Frankie was a fraction younger than me. He was about a month younger than me, thereabouts. So he continually referred to me as an old man. You see, I was the old man, he was the young one. And then we were always keen to get the jumps in and the flying hours in. And when we were not working with when we didn't have a course of our own, we used to muck in and help the other course. So I was working with a chap named Len Berry. I was giving him a hand, dispatching and working on the DZ. I went in one evening, and I saw Len sat down. I sat down by him. I had a cup of tea and one thing and another, talking. I was just about to leave. So I thought, no, Len said, have another cup of tea. So I had another cup of tea. And this lad Turner happened to come in. And I've just arranged with Len to go with him in the morning and go dispatching with him. And Frankie came in and said, hey, he said, that's not fair. He said, you went this morning. I said, well, I can go in the morning, I'm doing nothing. Oh, no, he said, not fair, I've not been flying for a week. He said, why can't I go? I said, all right, Frankie, please yourself, you go in the morning then. Okay. And next morning, I had an extra lie-in. He woke us up, throwing stones on the window, and I went out, and I saw him there, sat on the truck, he was making the usual V sign to me as he went away, laughing away. So I had my breakfast. Our training area was just outside of Joy del Col. And when I got there, there was a group of trainees all sat down. So I went up to them and said, what are you doing here? Where's your instructor? They said, oh, an aircraft crashed on the DZ. Well, we had no telephone connection with the DZ, so I got these chaps working away, and I just had to hang on and wait till something happened. Another friend of mine came back named Gascoigne. He saw me. He said, oh, he said, thank God you're here. I said, why? He said, I thought you were in that aeroplane. I said, no. I said, why? He said, it's crashed. They'd all been killed. I said, Frankie Turner. He said, yeah. I said, oh, dear. And what had happened, they were dropping at 800 feet, and the pilot flying that aeroplane had only been with us a few weeks. He'd not flown Hudson much. He'd just flown Wellingtons. And from what I can gather, he'd done his run, and we always dropped a dummy first and see how the wind was going, see where to drop the troops. And then we dropped an instructor to see what it was like with a, you know, a human being on the end of the fighter, like. And then we'd do the drop. The first drop they used to do was in what they call a slow pair, that two of them out together, or four of them out together. They gradually built it up so they jumped out in a stick. So the technique that morning was they would drop the instructor, then they would run round and drop the first two out. And Frankie was dispatching with a UT jump master from one of the squadrons, aircrew chap who was a dispatcher. And as the aircraft ran in, it stalled. Now, I'm not a technician, not a pilot, but I've been told that what happens in that case with a Hudson, the pilot should have increased speed on the side in which had the stall, which in this case heavenly happened to be the port side, should have increased the power to get him out of the stall. Whereas in the Wellington, in a similar situation, it controls it with the ailerons and the elevators and all this. And the story is that he automatically did the thing that he would have done in a Wellington. And the result was the aircraft, just the stall became worse, and it just straight in. And when they got to the aircraft, one of the first man, there was one man lying by the plane with the, and he was barely alive, he died in hospital, but he had his parachute out practically, he had all the rigging lines, and part of the canopy was starting to come out heavenly. And they think that what happened was Frankie was dispatching, realised what had happened, pushed this man out. And the interesting thing was, this static line they found was not fastened up. It must have happened just before they started to hook the first two up. And his static line had wrapped round a bar inside, one of the other seat, and must have held it sufficiently to allow the first part of the parachute to come out, but not the whole of the parachute to come out. So I've often wondered, you know, would I have been in that aeroplane on that particular day? And it makes me sad when I think about it. You know, I think about him. And I've had a tree dedicated to him. Because I feel that it's just one of those coincidences. Anyway, shortly after this, I was posted back to Ringway, Manchester. And, of course, as we know, the war finished in 1945. Then, although we were busy, Ringway, I'm not too sure just the actual dates when we left Ringway, but I think we left Ringway about 1946, and we moved up to RAF Upper Heyford, and then, of course, in peacetime, which is a different sort of kettle of fish, if you like, till wartime, we still got a paratroops to train. But the sort of urgency, perhaps, was not quite the same when, during the wartime, we were training them, taking a fortnight for the course. In peacetime, the course was extended to a month, except for the territorials, who were... they still did their two-week course.
Now, did you prepare anybody for any post-war operations?
After the war?
Yes.
Not that I know of. I don't know, because during the war, we knew who these people were, because they all wore, as I say, we found there was a language problem, because they were mainly foreigners that we had involved in all that sort of thing. Their cap badges were invariably different. You might have a pioneer cap badge or mainly the intelligence corps cap badge or anything like that. So we wouldn't really know at that time where they would.
You were in Cyprus, I think, at the end of your career.
I was in Cyprus there,
was
yes.
Was that at the time of the hostilities with AOK there?
No. No. No.
So it was peaceful?
It was peaceful, yes. I suspect that I did have the odd one or two who were not what they seem. I don't know how much I can tell you about all this. How much I might be breaking the...
You mean Cypriots or British?
No. Listen, in this country, in England, in Britain, in England, at the parachute school.
So people engage on secret work?
Yes. I don't know just how far I can go. The people that I suspected, shall we say, at the time, were involved in certain operations, though I never had anything directly to do with them. There may have been people that I trained that were not what they seemed to be, put it that way.